Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. The argument that schools have gone too far in emphasizing testing over genuine learning and student growth, hours and hours devoted to multiple-choice tests that measure a small part of a student's intelligence but determine a massive part of their future, has begun to bring change to public education in Kentucky. An interesting course correction is underway, and if you're a student, a teacher, a parent, an employer, or just one who cares about the way future generations learn what they need to know to thrive and prosper, this latest from Education Series contributor Gil Hunter is for you.
Dr. Lou Young is a longtime teacher, assistant superintendent, and superintendent, and now serves as chair of the Kentucky Board of Education. She also directs the University of Kentucky's Center for Next Generation Leadership and Next Generation Educational Partnerships. Dr. Young, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Gil.
Very good. Good to spend some time with you. My first question is kind of based on what the Kentucky Department of Education rolled out not too long ago, what's called a United We Learn initiative. Dr. Young, I understand you're one of the champions of this initiative. So can you start by telling us what it means that United We Learn?
Yes, I would be happy to. The name of the initiative is a play on United We Stand, our motto, of course. And the idea is that lots of voices need to be included in decisions about teaching and learning all across the Commonwealth. And so our commissioner, Dr. Jason Glass, worked with the Center for Innovation and Education, with our State Board of Education, and with stakeholders across Kentucky on a listening tour to envision what a bold new future of teaching and learning in Kentucky should be. And out of that Kentucky Coalition for Advancing Education was born this Kentucky United We Learn initiative. And the state board has established a goal in support of that work, which includes broad stakeholder engagement, including the voices of students, as well as an opportunity for folks to really develop a big vision for what the future of public education in Kentucky should be.
So you mentioned this big vision around a future for education. And I heard you mention students. Clearly, students have a place in the future of education and in the future of the health of Kentucky. What does that future look like, in your opinion? And what role do students that are in today's classrooms really play in shaping that future?
I really appreciate delving into how students can be engaged in envisioning the future of learning for themselves and for those students who will follow them in our system. For me, engaging student voices has always been a really important part of the way I think about my work in public education and now at the university. And in throughout the time from the coalition into United We Learn, Dr. Glass and the team at the Department of Education have engaged students in the conversations. I once worked with some students who said, don't have conversations about us without us. So engaging students as active participants in the coalition and now in the United We Learn initiative gives us a chance to put our money where our mouth is when it comes to student agency and voice. And you ask about what that future might be. We have lots of examples of the deeper learning movement across the U.S., and it really looks like relevant, meaningful learning experiences for students. And I use those two adjectives really intentionally. Relevant because there is some ability to transfer the learning to new settings, and we know how important that's going to be in the 21st century, as well as meaningful in that it needs to be important to the students and of interest to the students as well. So those are just kind of glimpses of what I think this bold new era of learning in Kentucky will look like.
That's terrific. Now, you've mentioned deeper learning, and I see where there's a connection in United We Learn to kind of a focus on deeper learning. When I hear that phrase, my first thought is deeper than what? And maybe you can speak to that, but I wonder whether deeper learning is somehow a reaction to the history of standardized testing that we've kind of worked through in this state and across the country, and maybe even, maybe I'm stretching here, but maybe even to the struggles for meaningful knowledge development that have been brought on by the pandemic. If I'm off base on any of this, by all means, please correct me. But can you explain really just what's meant by deeper learning as you use it?
Sure, absolutely. And no, Gil, you're not off base at all. It's really both of those things and more. Deeper learning has become a moniker that we use across the U.S. and, in fact, internationally to describe the kind of meaningful learning experiences I touched on a little bit earlier. Frankly, a lot of folks are bending toward the use of the term student-centered learning. I like that one as well. We don't get too bent out of shape about whether the term is right or not, but the elements of deeper learning are what is so important in this conversation. As I mentioned earlier, it's a lot about lines of inquiry, projects and passion projects, opportunities for outside school wall learning. Deeper than what? Deeper than a more traditional test-based, test-focused curriculum and student experience. And under No Child Left Behind, we really pivoted toward that kind of learning. And we heard voices from Kentucky, especially families and students, that said that's not what the experiences for their students of the future should be. That was not their aspiration for kids. So deeper, more personalized, more meaningful learning experiences, not driven by standardized testing.
Gosh, Lou, you mentioned parents and kids, but when I hear that, I've got to think that teachers celebrate that opportunity as well.
You're exactly right. We hear from teachers all the time. I'm also at the University of Kentucky, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I get to do a lot of the similar work there in addition to my work at the State Board of Ed. And frankly, when we talk to teachers about what this vision entails, what deeper learning looks like in practice in the classroom, they consistently respond, that's what I went into teaching for.
Right.
And so there really is a lot of joy in the deeper learning experience for teachers and for learners.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, as maybe teachers' ears have perked up at this part of our conversation, maybe we should repeat that student-directed focus that you have, don't talk about us without us. And I definitely see this opportunity for kind of more meaningful, you used that word before, and deeper relationships in learning between teachers and students as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely the hope. Changing that relationship to a coaching and mentoring relationship where teachers get to facilitate the learning. It might look very different from one learner to the next. That may be a better way to think about equity and how to meet students' needs. And at the same time, we don't get to student agency by curtailing teacher agency. Those two things actually flourish in the same conditions and in the same environment. So if we do this right, when we do this right, I believe that there will be more joy and experiences for teachers and for students, and that families will really appreciate the shift as well.
You mentioned community beyond the school walls. Can you talk about any examples where that's happening well?
One of the initiatives that is an outgrowth of the coalition and now part of United We Learn is called Local Laboratories of Learning. And we have three phases of school districts and communities who have stepped up in partnership to say, we would like to be a part of the co-creation and co-design of the future of teaching, learning, and assessment in Kentucky. One of those that comes to mind is Shelbyville, and they've worked really, really closely with the business and industry community, as well as agricultural and education healthcare communities across Shelby County, to co-design what a portrait of a Shelby County learner should entail. And so there's a lot of workforce implications for that. There's certainly implications at the points where students matriculate from elementary to middle to high and on into the workforce. And so having a United We Learn vision for the community of Shelby County portends really well for the ability of that community to use their schools and public education as the pipeline that they need for successful workplace experiences and families across the community. And that involvement has really informed this initiative moving forward.
Can you explain more about how a local laboratory of learning scales? What's happening in Shelby County? I assume that's being replicated in other places across the state. And what's the effect of that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so having these local communities and school districts lock arm and say, let's talk about the future of the workforce and of our school system together as a community and dream together about what that could be. And so these local laboratories of learning are in communities across Kentucky. Every geographic region is represented. And they're tackling different aspects of the future of learning, but they're doing it in partnership in every case with deep community engagement. And so the commissioner set a really clear expectation at the beginning of United We Learn that this would be a sincere effort to engage communities, not a token effort, not for show, but a sincere engagement opportunity for families and communities to come together and help us aspire to the new future for our system. And that's really different from the way leaders have approached these kinds of big change initiatives in the past. Mm-hmm. This is about all stakeholders, not just the usual suspects.
As I hear what you're saying about community leaders and the opportunities they have to get involved, to raise their hands, to partner with schools, that schools are opening their doors or knocking down their walls might be a better metaphor for that. I know that there are a lot of community leaders listening to this conversation now, and it sounds like there is an invitation on the state level for them to engage with schools that are already involved in these kinds of partnerships or this kind of laboratory work, and additional opportunities will be coming. Is that true?
I think that's exactly right. We don't want to get ahead of the engagement process by determining exactly what the outcomes of this work will be. Again, a common mistake made by well-intentioned leaders in the past. We really want to commit to the organic nature of community engagement. But you ask about scaling or spreading earlier, and I do think this work will spread at the grassroots level from community to community. And then that will bubble up for us in terms of policy, the work of the General Assembly, certainly will inform the work of the Department of Ed as an agency moving forward. But it starts as this coalition of community members and educators who say, this is what we want for the future of our children. And so then that's when we have a lot of good grassroots information that we can use to let the policy naturally follow the initiative so that barriers are removed and that that further paves the way for deeper, more personalized learning for every child in the Commonwealth.
More personalized, too. That's a great phrase to add to this conversation we've had. Dr. Young, you were introduced as a champion of this United We Learn and Deeper Learning initiative, and I think you've championed it well here in this conversation. We've covered a lot of ground, but I think we've gotten deeper, to use a loaded word here, into a topic that we're probably going to hear a lot more about in the coming weeks, months, and potentially even years. And I thank you for introducing everybody to this topic and to some opportunities that we all have to get involved in new ways. Finally, you mentioned the teachers and the grassroots work that they too are doing. And I know that teachers will appreciate the opportunity to see their work in new, fresh ways. And I think that's really important and important to the health of education in Kentucky. So I thank you for that work, and I thank you for joining me today.
Well, it has been my pleasure, and I would be remiss to not thank those 60,000 educators across Kentucky's public schools for the really hard, grueling work that they've engaged in across the time of the pandemic. And I hope this is a chance for them to emerge from those really difficult years and to look up and think about what the future of their profession holds for them. And I just encourage them to keep doing the great work that they do for kids. And then hopefully we'll embrace this new future and everyone will find great joy in that. Thank you so much for including me. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you once again for joining us. I'm Gil Hunter, Interim Dean of the College of Education and Applied Human Sciences at EKU, and I've been joined by Dr. Lou Young, Chair of the Kentucky Board of Education. Dr. Young, have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Gil. You too.
Dr. Gil Hunter is Interim Dean of Education at EKU. All across Appalachia, there are examples of a growing outdoor economy. Converging cultural factors are making this the moment to expand the outdoor economy in Appalachia. Travel is a $60 billion industry in the region, and at least two-thirds of visitors come to the area for some form of outdoor activity. Kim Coversmith reports on it for the Daily Yonder, and she joins us from Berea. Welcome, Kim.
Thanks, Tom. Good to talk with you again.
So, Kim, if you could first just kind of give us an overview of the article, what's it about?
Well, I talk to different people across the region that I've been working for a long term on developing an outdoor economy. I talk to some people who've had some real successes and some organizations that really support places that are looking at developing it or working on it. I also looked at a place in Pennsylvania called the Pennsylvania Wilds that's developed a real entrepreneurship center around it in their region, and a new initiative that crosses state borders that has some real promise.
Are the economic impacts of this evenly distributed throughout the region, or are some areas seeing more benefits than others?
Well, it has been shown that the outdoor economic benefits are really kind of focused in major cities and certain places of rural places that have a lot of interest. That'd be like Western North Carolina and around the Smokies. And so there are some places that are being left behind right now.
And so in the article, you mentioned that there is a movement underway to help rural towns and villages all across Appalachia, to help them access benefits that they might need to build their capacity for this economy.
Some of them have been going on for a while and some are just starting. And one of the things that really struck me is how these really are going outside of traditional silos. So some of them are working with people in a number of different industries within a community. If you think about outdoor recreation, people need places to eat. They need ways to get around. They need the resource that they're visiting to be well stewarded. And the other piece is to go outside of geographical boundaries, realizing that if one place can benefit when places nearby have resources that people can access.
Tell us about the Appalachian Gateway Communities Initiative. What is that?
Yeah, that was operated by the Conservation Fund, which is a national nonprofit, and it's supported by the Appalachian Regional Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts. And it helps gateway communities, which are identified as communities that are access points to public lands, helping those communities develop some resources in their own community. It might be infrastructure, more amenities, services, some sort of programming or marketing, whatever their community needs to move to the next level of the outdoor economy in their community. And it gives them a coach and the resources that they can help get them to the next place.
Would you say that this is one of those rising tides lifts all boats situations, or are there complicated unintended consequences to think about?
Well, there's always complications when you're looking at something this large. I would say, though, from the people I talked with, there's a lot of promise that because they're looking so broadly to incorporate a lot of different places, a lot of different communities, and this realization that really the outdoor resources that one community has is only enriched when other places also have outdoor resources. And that also crosses over into outdoor gear manufacturing, which is an aspect of the outdoor economy I didn't necessarily think about before I did this. But if they can't access all the materials they need in their own community, the ability to get it from another Appalachian town holds real promise for making it a regional product instead of just a community product.
We've talked about trails, but what about agritourism? You cite North Carolina as an example of how that can work. Tell us what those Tar Heels are up to.
Well, their number one industry is agriculture, and I think they're one of the few states that has somebody on in the Department of Agriculture whose job is to be the agritourism promoter. And so not only does Annie work with farmers who wanting to get into agritourism and all of its different forms, but also they developed a mobile app that helps people who are interested in visiting producers connect to where they are, finding if it's a U-Pick farm or a place to get married or a place to have a family picnic. And so they can find the farm that has the kind of the resource they're looking for through the app.
Well, Kim, Eastern Kentucky right now is enjoying a pretty strong streak of entrepreneurialism, especially among young adults who are making a go of it in the region. And I read in your article about the mission of the Outdoor Rivers Coalition. Tell us more about that.
Yes, they're actually a multi-state coalition supported by the Appalachian Regional Commission, and it's a pilot for other multi-state industry clusters, really looking at how different areas can complement what's going on in the whole region. And so they are working on developing a self-assessment tool so that individual communities can self-assess how they're doing and what they want their next step to be to get ready to welcome an outdoor economy. And also looking at how that can cross over resources between communities.
In the article, Kim, you quote the leader of a nonprofit in Pennsylvania who notes that an early challenge was how to respond to this question. Can an underserved region that has been through a lot of hardship, left to fight over scraps with a bit of a self-esteem problem, put differences aside and come together in a real way to grow this new industry for the good of all communities? That seems like a very tall order, especially in today's fractured atmosphere. But what do you think? Can that be accomplished?
I hope so. The people that I spoke with were rather optimistic. And one thing that they talked about, there was an outdoor economy conference this year in Cherokee, North Carolina, and had over 600 people that attended. And several people told me about different connections that were made there. For example, one manufacturer was looking for a particular material for something they were making and found out that another person represented at the conference, their organization, their business was making that product. So they were able to connect. And the other one was Pennsylvania Wildlands is in the running for the Build Back Better Challenge, which is a grant fund from the government. And they were talking about how supportive the other people at the conference were from other places and the way that it would lift up the whole region.
So there is some good energy happening out there.
Yes, there really is. I was encouraged and excited. So, and I was really interested. I guess I often think of it being very limited. When you hear outdoor economy, I think people first start thinking about tourism. Mm-hmm. But several people talked about how tourism can be an extractive industry. And so how do we take the outdoor economy and people coming here to visit and kind of take it to that next step of getting them more invested in communities, but getting them maybe want to live there, move there, manufacture gear there? And also how do we get the entrepreneurs and the local people having their wealth in their community generated through more than just, you know, people coming to visit and then leaving again.
And what do they talk about on that point? How can tourism be viewed as extractive?
Well, I think it's just people, you know, Appalachia has, of course, a history of extraction. People come in, mm-hmm. take what they want, and then leave. It's a similar thing with tourism. People come in, they take the views, the sights, the experiences they want, and then they leave without maybe making a positive impact or a deeper connection with the people, the culture, and the place.
So the challenge is to figure out how to reverse that.
Exactly. So, and the Pennsylvania Wilds, they one of the things they do up in Pennsylvania is that they're really developing an entrepreneurial network. And so their state park and other visitor centers, their gift shops are run by this network of entrepreneurs. And so all of the products that are sold there are sourced regionally, made by local artisans who also have access to their brand that they can incorporate and also cooperative marketing efforts. So really trying to figure out how to integrate those local entrepreneurs into the bigger picture of how to incorporate the local entrepreneurs into benefiting from the tourists that come.
All right, that's Kim Cobersmith in Berea. You can find Kim's article, How Appalachia is Growing Its Outdoor Economy Through Collaborations and Capacity Building, online at dailyyonder.com. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after the break, water issues in a town in the western part of the state draw new attention to Kentucky's leaky earthen dams, the value to a business of welcoming a variety of points of view.
You need to be able to have people who see things differently.
And an addition to our menu of series.
We do have records of Native American villages in Kentucky before the European settlers came over en masse.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members across the state. Co-ops are proud to support Ronald McDonald Houses in Kentucky through sponsorship and volunteerism. More information at www.togetherwesaveky.com. WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker, provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
There are more than 1,000 dams across Kentucky, most more than a half century old, and taken as a whole, our dams earn a D-plus from the American Society of Civil Engineers, with the organization warning that Kentucky has seen an increase in the number of high-hazard dams, those with the potential for loss of life and significant property destruction if they fail. In many cases, this is due to downstream development creating populations at risk that weren't there before. The latest Kentucky community to grapple with a worrisome nearby dam is the Crittenden County town of Marion, where too little rainfall combined with a leak along the bottom of the dam holding back Lake George, the town's main water reservoir, has left residents and businesses with strict water use limits. Liam Niemeyer with a member station WKMS reports that memos written back in the spring by dam inspectors with the Kentucky Division of Water show arguments and tensions between local leaders in Marion and state officials in Frankfort over what to do about the deteriorating condition of the Lake George Dam. Marion City Administrator Adam Ledford says state dam inspectors at the time weren't giving clear advice on how to address the growing sinkhole in the Lake George Dam.
It seemed like they were more interested in the concerns about legal responsibility rather than being a helpful participant.
Crittenden County Judge Executive Perry Newcomb says state inspectors advised against breaching the dam but didn't give clear instructions, so it was decided to go ahead and breach the earthen dam to try to control water flow instead of allowing the sinkhole to grow even larger.
It was uncomfortable to just sit and watch the center of the levee basically erode and deteriorate to the point where you have a gaping hole in the middle of the levee.
According to the Crittenden Press, the Kentucky Army National Guard has been hauling 50,000 gallons of water a day to keep the town of 3,000 hydrated. Farmers have also come to the rescue by adding 180,000 gallons per day with tractor-trailer tankers. Local people are being asked to report alphabetically based on their last name to pick up water, with a state driver's license required to collect it. A state of emergency in Marion has been extended by Governor Beshear until at least December 30th.
Takes a while to see it.
Remote work really accelerated during the stay-at-home days of the pandemic, and that went on long enough for many people to discover that they really like the arrangement a lot more than all that's involved in getting out to the office every day. Recent surveys by Microsoft and McKinsey found 40% of workers thinking about leaving their jobs, but fewer and fewer who do are reverting to traditional office jobs, preferring the remote option. Employers have had to adjust to that, so now there's a business in helping companies accept and make changes and derive some benefits in the process. It's the focus of the latest Middle Tech podcast, provided to Eastern Standard by the folks who are tracking high-tech startups in this region.
Welcome back to Middle Tech on WEKU. You've got Logan Jones and Evan Knowles here, the co-host of the Middle Tech podcast. And we just sat down this evening with Darren Myrner and Kirsten Moorfield, who are the co-founders of Cloverleaf. So Cloverleaf is an awesome platform that's being built to really help teams understand each other. Whether those are remote teams or in-person teams, they're really kind of pulling the curtain back on team members' personalities, how they like to solve problems, how they like to deal with issues, and just building this tool that allows for a lot more robust communication and allows for that communication to happen a lot quicker, especially if you're in a remote culture. And speaking of culture, it is also a great tool for building that in a remote way. And something that was special about this interview is Evan is actually a customer of Cloverleaf. So that made for an interesting perspective because Evan actually got to talk through his experience using the platform, what the dashboard actually looked like for him, the different ways that he utilized that for his team. So, Evan, what did you think of that interview?
I thought it was great. You know, they're both brilliant founders. You know, they both have different backgrounds, which I think is important. That's something we talk about is different perspectives, different thought patterns, and all that leads into culture, like Logan was saying. And as he said, I'm a customer. I think building culture is essential, especially early in a startup. And I've used their product and it's helped. So I'm looking forward to you all learning more about them. And hopefully you guys can leverage this as well. And just maybe not leverage the platform, but just learn about, you know, why it's important to understand more about yourself and your teammates and what that can lead to as far as productivity, success, and just overall happiness in the workplace. I think one thing that Kirsten hit on several times is you should be very proud of the work you do. And if you're not, that's a really hard place to be in. And the more you understand about yourself and your teammates, the more you can be proud of where you work and improve the place you work. So I think this is a great conversation for everybody to learn from.
Thanks for listening. Let's dive on in.
And before we get too detailed into, you know, the problem you guys are solving and the way you guys are doing it with your platform, give us an idea of the stage of business you're in. You know, how big is the team? How far along are you guys? Give us a sense of size and progress.
Yeah, so I would say we're at a Series A stage. We're actually in the process of raising, you know, a Series A / A plus, depending on what you want to call it these days. We have 22 full-time employees, 20, I think 8 if you include part-time. And we have just under 1 million users, which is just kind of crazy to think about. We actually probably will cross that threshold in March. So really the last 2 years just been a roller coaster in a really good way, really fun way. And we've had, you know, 4x growth the last 2 years and are anticipating another 3x for this year. So, yeah.
Very exciting. And I'm one of those users. And so are my teammates at my startup, Simba. And so we came to learn about you guys through a consulting agency that was part of one of our awards that we had won and came with that program. And I love the product. I think it's helped us a lot. So I want to dive in here. And as we talk about the product, I can give my own thoughts as we talk through the benefits of it. But right off the bat, you know, it's all around building healthy culture by understanding your teammates and learning more about them and understanding how to communicate with them and what motivates them and things of that nature. But from your all's perspective, all this leads into culture. So what is some of the key pillars of culture in your all's mind just to start off this conversation?
There's two main facets from all the work that I've done, and they're super academic terms, so bear with me. The first one is cognitive diversity, which basically means like the way that people think is different. And so, you know, you two people see a problem and they see it very different ways. They have different ideas of how to solve it, basically. And the other one is psychological safety, which means it is accepted for people to disagree, basically. Like, you're not going to be judged as being difficult or, you know, like trying to cause problems if you actually share your cognitive diversity. So you need to be able to have people who see things differently. And it needs to be a place where it is perfectly acceptable and actually encouraged to say like, hey, you know, I actually saw this in a different way, or like, you know, I disagree on this thing. A lot of what we deal with is actually all the different ways that that can be. So like one thing might be like, you know, some people are super detail oriented. Other people are really big picture thinking. So I'll use myself and our CTO as an example. I'll come at a problem and I'll say, oh, easy. Here's how you solve it. Like, boom. And Matt, our CTO, will be like, did you think about these 75 potential issues from that? And I'm like, no, I didn't. And you know what? I'm really tired. I'm gonna need a nap now that you just brought all that up. And that can usually lead to problems, right? Like, if I didn't know what I knew, like, I might think he doesn't trust me or he thinks I'm incompetent, right? And he might think the same thing about me. But because we know what we know, we actually appreciate those differences inside of each other and can use that for our good.
Got it. Yeah. See, what I noticed was, when I took this test, me and my teammates, I learned a lot about them. I learned that I thought I was most similar to one of my teammates. I turned out to be the most dissimilar to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, learning those kind of things and understanding how to communicate with them is so important. And I agree with you that diversity and thought and the way you think and the way you communicate is so important, because if you have the same of a lot of thoughts in a company, you can't innovate. That leads to innovation. And how does coaching play into this? So what I love about the product as well is you guys are trying to automate the coaching process. I love the emails I get that take the information that I've put into Cloverleaf and then suggest ways to talk to my team or suggest ways to be thinking introspectively about how I manage. How do you guys incorporate coaching into this, and what's the importance of coaching?
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways, and companies make a lot of investments in a lot of different tools for development. I think the most common or the most simple way is online learning, e-learning, right? Just have a bunch of courses, you consume information. You know, the nice thing about coaching, and whether it's done with a human and it's one-to-one, or it's, you know, in a group environment, or it's automated, right, in the way that we're doing it, is really you have someone that comes alongside you, right? It's kind of like that trusted, you know, we use terms like Sherpa, right, or Sage. Those are terms that, you know, really kind of create this imagery or emotion around having somebody that is wiser and can walk alongside you and point out these things that are either hidden to you, either about your own blind spots or areas where maybe you just don't see the whole picture. And that's really what we're doing for behavior. One of the things that we said early on in terms of our origin story was exposing this kind of hidden layer of behavior that sits below the surface. And when we talk about automated coaching, that's exactly what we do, right? We're right there alongside you and the tools that you use every day to really expose those things that you couldn't have known. One of the big use cases for our product that we never really saw, and we don't, if you go out and look at our website, there's nothing on there that really advertises this as a use case, but it's onboarding. And the idea there is like, hey, you're a new manager, or maybe you just got added to this new team. You know, sometimes it can take months or even years to understand some of these idiosyncrasies of how people work. You know, simple example, like we have an awesome board member and all of his emails are like a single sentence. And we're kind of laughing about this at the most recent board meeting because, you know, if you just saw that, you're kind of like, you could draw a lot of conclusions about who Kevin is and how he operates, right? And the reality is it's just how he processes information and it's how he communicates, and it speaks to his desire for efficiency and, you know, get straight to the point and drawing towards conclusions. And putting language to that and giving that kind of information early in an employee or a team member's life cycle in a team or in a company is huge towards helping them feel known, helping them know the people that they're working with, and really avoid pitfalls and kind of, you know, traps that people, I think, fall into with misunderstandings and, you know, ultimately leads to conflict or poor performance.
Kind of what I'm getting out of this is how nice it would be to just have the curtain pulled back on my own psyche without having to be like vulnerable, I guess, with my team, or having to go through all the iterations of, you know, working with somebody before finally understanding how they like to work. It's like just right at the front, you take this test, your guys' software is able to help people have that understanding right at the forefront. And then it's almost like having a really solid foundation to build from, to build a team on top of.
Hey, I'm all for vulnerability. I just think you can,
absolutely.
I hope we help get people there faster.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. I'm curious if you guys had to pick like one insight that Cloverleaf gives for a team, which one would you pick as like one of the most essential for team building and building culture?
I think really it's that trust component. We have a phrase that we use, and I think this is kind of borne out in our own culture, and it's that everyone has value, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we come from a place, and I think you experience that in the product, is mm-hmm. that, you know, we're coming from this place that everyone has value, and what we want to do is expose that unique value to the other people on the team. And when that is known, right, people get to a level of trust. And I think trust, time and time again, we've seen is really a key aspect. And that's really the thing that we are trying to build with teams. And it's also the thing that we really work hard to make sure that we keep intact and grow and strengthen in our own culture internally. Because if that's there, any sort of disagreements or any sort of, you know, differences in perspectives can really be overcome, because you're never questioning either, A, do I have value, or does that other person have value? And I think if you ask someone like, hey, does that person have value? Of course, they're going to say yes. But deep inside, there's all these questions and doubts, and their reactions and responses to people seem to indicate that that person doesn't have value.
I think one of the helpful, like, practical applications of this, of like, how do you build that trust, is, first of all, it really starts with yourself. Like, you can't just be like, I wish everybody understood me. You know, you gotta be open to understanding the people around you. And through that, you can model this, and then people can open up to you more. But I think, like, one of the triggers that it's really helpful to think about is the next time you're in a meeting and somebody starts asking you 75 questions, or, you know, pitches a big idea you don't understand their details of, whatever it is for you. And you start to, you notice that thing in your head that's like, well, of course Kirsten's doing that again. Like, pause, capture that thought and think like, okay, wait a second. If Kirsten has value, what could she be getting at? Maybe she doesn't think the same way I do. What could really be happening here? And what questions can I start to ask to better understand that? When you do that, that changes everything. For, like, people notice it. People notice that you didn't have your gut reaction. People notice that you approached it with curiosity and open-mindedness. And that starts to shift the culture, no matter if you're the CEO or the new intern on the team.
If you enjoyed that conversation, you can find the full interview on the Middle Tech podcast feed, on your favorite podcast platform, or you can visit us at middletech.com. For those unfamiliar with Middle Tech, we exist to grow the startup and tech ecosystem in this region through media. We've been around for about 4 years now, talking with some of the top entrepreneurs in this region. For WEKU and Eastern Standard, I'm Logan Jones, co-host and executive producer of the Middle Tech podcast. Thanks for listening.
Reggie Van Stockham, lawyer, teacher, biologist, writer, guitarist, will be with us from time to time for conversations about his journey logs. These are extensive travels that chronicle life along the back roads of Kentucky. Places like our first stop in Estill County, with its welcome sign telling us that we're entering a place where the bluegrass kisses the mountains, an area also known as the Knobs. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Reggie.
Thank you, Tom. What a pleasure it is to be here. This is an August broadcast, and I'm very pleased to be part of it.
Well, your treks take us to the kinds of places that we too often drive past without a lot of thought to what we're missing if we would just slow down for a moment, pull over, and take in something of kind of a time machine of the landscape. Tell us what you'll be sharing with our listeners.
Well, let's start with that very famous place on the Kentucky River where Irvine, or Irvin as they pronounce it, now sits. It's the famous ford of the Kentucky River right at the base of the Knobs, coming out of the eastern mountains of Kentucky. Now, Irvin is just on the other side of Berea and Richmond as you travel down from Lexington on I-75. But how few people get off and say, let's go take a look at the Kentucky River right there at Irvin, and the railroad town just upstream at Ravenna. It's well worth the time and the visit. And in fact, if you come through Richmond, you'll pass through Bybee, which is the location of that famous Bybee pottery factory that's been there for a couple of hundred years.
And we'll probably explore that in depth a little bit later on in this series. But you wrote an article about Estill County. It's titled Kentucky's Pillars of Hercules. What's that about?
Well, if you think about it, and you think of the Mediterranean, how famous the Straits of Gibraltar were, that constriction at the mouth of the Mediterranean allowed one to pass into the wondrous world encompassed by the shorelines around the Mediterranean. If you think of eastern Kentucky as its own kingdom, then the Pillars of Hercules, the entranceway into the majestic land contained therein, would be where the Kentucky River exited, where the three forks of the Kentucky River come together at Beattyville and then roar down out of the Knobs into the great palisades of the Kentucky River. And where is that? It's at Irvin and Ravenna. If you want to enter this kingdom, you follow the Kentucky River upstream, and Irvin and Ravenna are my Pillars of Hercules.
And you mentioned that Ravenna is a railroad town. It was established by the L&N, the Louisville and Nashville Railroad.
many, many, many decades ago. And there are efforts being made now to revive that part of its history with a railroad museum. Another place there that is of real interest to me, and we're going to pursue this in a subsequent series on Native American history in Kentucky. It's a place that Daniel Boone, with the help of John Finley, tried to find. And you described it as a magical Shawnee village.
Escapicathicke.
Okay. What is there, or was there, I should say?
It was on the Great Warrior's Path. Mm-hmm. Now, the Warrior's Path is what the pioneers found when they came through the Cumberland Gap and what got them into the mountains of Kentucky. They veered off it. But originally, when Daniel Boone came through, he was brought in by a fellow named John Finley, who is a mysterious figure of history. But they moved up the Warrior Trail.
And these were paths that were actually migratory trails, correct?
Well, yes. In fact, much of Kentucky, lots of eastern Kentucky, had a myriad pattern of bison trails. These are prairie bison herds that would cross the Ohio River and come to the licks of Kentucky. There was a giant path of them in the north central bluegrass. They would split off. They would cross at Irvin. At the Great Ford at Irvin, and that's where the Warrior's Path crossed because it followed that. And if you want to expand your imagination to even greater distances, you can consider the fact that before the bison, did the Pleistocene megafauna travel these routes? Did the giant sloths, the mammoths, and the mastodons, did they also follow or create these paths to the great salt licks of Kentucky like the ones down at Manchester? And you might say, well, now, Reggie, how can that be? Just go up to Big Bone Lick State Park in Kentucky, and that's where you'll find those megafauna.
Well, how about the village that we were talking about?
Well, it's interesting. The history of Kentucky occupation by peoples is a lot deeper than we think. Mm-hmm. We like to think, we being
European settlers?
Yeah, that's the right term. That's right. The European settlers who came into Kentucky, they like to think, well, there was no one here in mm-hmm. Kentucky. It was the dark and bloody ground, and it was a land that was kind of fought over, but people lived south and lived north. That's not incorrect for the impression that they saw. It is incorrect as to the factual basis. Native Americans had been living in Kentucky in great concentrations 10,000 years ago through the Archaic and the Woodland period, the Adena people, the Hopewell people. There was opposite the mouth of the Scioto River at South Portsmouth, Kentucky. There were earthworks up there, massive earthworks in Portsmouth itself. People were all over here, and at different times they would migrate into the eastern mountains to overwinter in the shelters and migrate back out into the bluegrass fields like around my home to villages where they would live during the summer. But we do have records of Native American villages in Kentucky before the European settlers came over en masse. There weren't many. And if you think about it, there's a couple of reasons we can attribute that. One was European diseases. By the time we were in Kentucky looking at the long knives or the long hunters came into Kentucky, European diseases had decimated the Native American population. And there's no question about it. The only question, I suppose, is was it 50% or 90% lethal, I suppose. But there was another factor that changed the human topography of Kentucky by the time we got here. The Dutch armed the Iroquois Nation in return for pelts. And as soon as the Iroquois got firearms, they went to war to the west to drive all other Native Americans out of the Ohio, what is now Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky. They literally swept all of the Native Americans out of that area. And the Shawnee, who traditionally lived in Kentucky and in southern Ohio, for example, they were driven south. Some went all the way down to the coast. Nashville, Tennessee, was founded by a band of Shawnees who were driven south. And we have a record from their leader, who was half French and half Shawnee, who took his band going south and stopped at the village Escapicathicke on the Warrior's Path just north of Irvine, outside of Clay City. So we know that it was there. We know that it was a healthy population when his band moved down. We also know that the trader, John Finley, came up the Kentucky River in 1751 and was taken to Escapicathicke by Shawnee that he met at Big Bone Licks. And he built a little stockade there. It was a tough time. There was war in the colonies. He may or may not have been held captive, but he left or escaped. He later met Daniel Boone at Braddock's defeat in the Revolutionary War and told Daniel Boone, "You ought to see this place I was at before I came here." 15 years later, 1769, he shows up in Daniel Boone's home and says, "I can't make it down the river there anymore. But if you'll take me to this thing called the Warrior's Path, I'll take you to this village I was at." And that's how Daniel Boone got into Kentucky. That's how Daniel Boone got on top of Pilot Knob. That's how he looked out and saw the bluegrass, but also saw that the village had been abandoned.
All right. If we had a bookmark, we'd stick it right there. And I want to also give a shout out to Landra Lewis, who's going to be joining us to dig into the history of just what you were talking about extensively over time, and we're looking forward to that. Reggie Van Stockham, lawyer, teacher, biologist, writer, guitarist. Thanks, Reggie.
Thank you, Tom.
Next week here on Eastern Standard, we're joined by WEKU's Sam Dick, who has captured the observations of the retiring David Shirey after 40 years in ministry, the last 8 as senior minister at Lexington Central Christian Church. And I'll talk with Dr. Leah Sade, associate professor of preaching and worship at Lexington Theological Seminary, about her efforts to unleash the power of the clergy as a change agent for climate action, helping congregations view climate change not so much as a political issue, but as something rooted in religion. And we'll have Tom Eblen's conversation with Eastern Kentucky author Bobby Kahn about her debut novel, A Story in Time, the story of a young woman who challenges the constraints of Depression-era Appalachia.
I wrote this book inspired by stories that I grew up hearing about my great-grandparents. My great-grandfather was a moonshiner, and he was in and out of prison. I had a newspaper clipping, or my parents did, that I would look at when I was little, of my great-grandpa with his arm around Al Capone in prison.
Dwayne Lundy will be here with Cannon Armstrong, owner of the Burl in Lexington, on how Kentucky in general and Lexington in particular have gained a presence on the worldwide stage of Americana and roots music. And joining our team of contributors, Brian Powers with American Esoterica, a podcast kind of reminiscent of Paul Harvey's Rest of the Story. It's about historical figures and events with some humor thrown in for good measure. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Spencer Shook, intern, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org. You can check out the Eastern Standard archive there. You can see our series, our partners, and a lot more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the coming edition. You can also find us at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU app, and on NPR One and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.